opportunities. Many of these people send their best and brightest to the US to study. And if you're not allowed to come in because you're on some kind of a watch list or something like that, because you don't follow reproductive policies, I think that would really hamper, progress for especially women in these countries and especially people who are of what I would call not of the kind of people that they would want, i.e., people who are sexually active, people who are homosexuals, and trans people and others. And so it's an imposition of the policies that you see on state and local levels here in the US to be put in other countries around the world.
We've been showing imagery of a woman named Valerie Huber. She's a white woman who represents Christian nationalists. She's been recruiting African and Middle Eastern autocrats for this GCD. There's no sense that this gets done with the approval of any of these populations. In many cases, these are not populations that are entitled to vote. Tell me about this. I mean, the optics of it, just the optics of it is weird. This white American woman going around telling Africans exactly or people in the Middle East how it is they should handle relations or matters having to do with gay people and reproductive rights. But beyond that, she seems to be pretty influential.
She is. And let me say this. I think, for us on the outside, it might look as though that's really weird to see a white woman doing this. But you have to understand the history of missionization and colonization in Africa makes people already susceptible to this kind of behavior. So if you're doing this through a Christian lens, in other words, if you're saying, oh, this is what Jesus would want, we want to focus on our families, this is what Christianity is all about, many of these nations are used to having missionaries and other people there. So when you have somebody like Huber coming into the country and sitting down with leaders and everything else and promising money and funds under the guise of, we are doing this for the Lord, then what you get is this sort of undercover way to get inside a nation and to begin to influence its policies through the guise of Christianity. And I think what is very important for people to understand is that these organizations already have footholds in these countries through churches. And so if you go in and you're dealing with pastors and others, then it makes it a lot easier to get to the leadership.
There's so much more we need to discuss about this. Anthea, thank you so much for just giving us the tip of the iceberg on this one. Anthea Butler is the chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania and a columnist for MSNBC Daily. She's also the author of White Evangelical Racism: The Politics of Morality in America.
Hello. We back giving something that you like.
Hello.
Hip hop with that vibe. Oh yeah.
Hello.
We always been in, but on the outside.
Hello.
Welcome to this experience. As if my name is Jimmy and my last name is Hendrix. Obviously you have an interest. How else would you have known that this 90s phenom was still the bomb, and that's not overblown. We are the difference between an Afro pick and a broken comb. About these maps, no caps, stay focused on the road. People to see, places to go, you must have known. Maybe you were at one of our shows. And then of course you know it's truly a celebration of ancestral pleasure zones. Here's the third installment of our trilogy. AD configuring me, starting with demons and epic love. Push came to shove, bullets in the chamber, it's time for one more shooting spree. After this, you can buy back our artillery. The narrative's been corrected, the name has been re-respected. The shell cases have been taken for proper perspective, and now we're known as just one of the best ever collectives.
Hello.
We back giving something that you like.
Hello.
Hip hop with that vibe. Oh yeah.
Hello.
We always been in, but on the outside.
Hello, how you doing? I hope you're doing fine. They say speech is rhyming first, when love is right behind. They say, brother, where you been? Boy, I've been on my grind, frequent flying, sipping on muscadine moonshine. Welcome to the party, you know we get it started. Sending love to the living and the dearly departed. Jump started like a focus with a faulty alternator. Hit the bait later, player, hit the accelerator. Yeah, I be in the booth, mostly venting. I'm a Gemini. Started with repenting, I'm relenting till we reach the sky. Thirsty for the truth and resenting those who teach a lie. Over 20 years representing it, this reaching out. Kudos, we got a new show for 23. That's a duo, the ones you know, bro, from overseas. With Farida and JJ Boogie, it's AD, that's the staple. But we got April and T3, niggas.
Hello. We back giving something that you like.
Hello.
Hip hop with that vibe. Oh yeah.
Hello.
We always been.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, activist and organizer Brian Becker joins us to discuss the nationwide protest on behalf of Palestine.
This is quite an extraordinary thing that's going on. Listen to what Brian has to say and be part of it.
Guest co-host Steve Rohde joins Michael Smith for an interview and update on the Julian Assange case.
It's looking like the CIA, which is really behind all of this, is going to succeed in getting Julian Assange brought to Virginia to try and put him in prison and close down investigative journalism.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Around the nation, peaceful campus protests against the Israeli genocide of Palestinians in Gaza are spreading. And they're meeting with a rash of arrests by local police departments, dozens of school suspensions, and even evictions from student dormitories. Many of those evicted have been students of color, students with disabilities, and first-generation students. In New York, the NYPD arrested 108 Columbia University students, giving them only 14 minutes to gather their belongings and leave their dormitories. New York University erected a plywood wall around Gould Plaza, an outdoor campus space in Greenwich Village, where police had earlier arrested protesting students. All this because they took part at the large protest. Officials at Harvard University closed Harvard Yard in anticipation of possible protests and suspended the student group Palestine Solidarity Committee. Police arrested 9 students at the University of Minnesota for their refusal to dismantle a pro-Palestinian encampment. And the California campus of Cal Poly Humboldt was shut down after students occupied a building there. In an April 23rd letter to the New York Times, nearly 60 parents of students at Columbia and Barnard from a variety of religious faiths and social backgrounds wrote that they, quote, find the actions taken by the administration deeply troubling and contrary to the principles of liberty, justice, and academic freedom that are fundamental to the mission of higher education. Joining us to discuss the massive wave of protest against the genocide of Palestinians in Gaza is Brian Becker. Brian is the director of the Answer Coalition. He's also a founder of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and he hosts the Socialist Program. Brian, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian, you've been on the ground literally for decades in terms of observing protest movements. Are you surprised at the national outpouring of support on behalf of the Palestinian people experiencing genocidal acts in Israel, by Israel?
Surprised in one way and not surprised in another way. This is the first time, I would say, in human history that human beings have been able to watch on a daily, almost hourly basis, a genocide being carried out. Even if the capitalist corporate-owned media in the United States doesn't cover it, people have social media and access to images. And in that sense, it's impossible not to be outraged. It's impossible to turn away. So even if people don't know the detailed history of British colonialism and its relationship to Zionism, if they don't know about the dispossession of the Palestinian people, if they don't know about the Nakba, they can see for themselves what's happening right now. And in that sense, it's not surprising because human beings normally are outraged by this kind of brutality and almost unlimited violence being perpetrated against the civilian population. But I am surprised in the sense that as someone who, Heidi, you mentioned, I've been organizing, not just observing, but organizing in solidarity with the people of Palestine for 40 years and have had some very important steps forward in the last 20 years where the Palestinian movement finally sort of broke the back of the taboo, even in the left, about talking about Palestine. I'm surprised at the level of mass movement on Palestine, inside the United States, inside the patron of the Israeli regime, we have to recognize that we have reached a historical marker. This is a turning point. There's no turning back. Israel is now viewed by a big part of the younger people in the United States as a pariah state, as an apartheid state, and that will never change. So in that sense, something very, very new has happened. And if you had asked me on October 6th, could this be happening 7 months later, I would be, oh, no, I would be startled. I'd be shocked. I'd be surprised. But everything has changed in the last 7 months.
Brian, indeed, with few exceptions, the world seems to be outraged at Israel's genocidal actions. Why not the American government?
Well, you know, there's different theories about why the Biden administration, even possibly at the cost of its own reelection, is so steadfastly supporting Netanyahu and this genocidal campaign. One theory is that the pro-Israeli lobby is so strong that it's dominating, it's controlling, it basically exercises an overwhelming impact on American politics. And it's a very powerful lobby. There's no denying it. But I think there's a more important reason, which is that Israel, at least since 1967, has been viewed by the Pentagon and the CIA as an extension of American power in the Middle East, in West Asia, in this resource-rich region of the world where perhaps two-thirds of the world's oil is. And I believe that that's the real reason. When Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, the U.S. administration sort of interpreted as an attack on America itself. That was the way the reaction was sort of tenored. And I think that that's because the U.S. actually does see Israel as an outpost of American power in the Middle East.
Brian, you have many friends and colleagues who are taking to the streets and protesting on college campuses across the country. What stories are you hearing from them?
Well, the most recent story that I would, you know, want to tell all of you about and tell your audience about is what happened a few nights ago, when the administration at Columbia University, echoing the demands of the right wing in the U.S. Congress, told student negotiators who had set up the encampment, and this was just days after the mass arrests that the administration carried out with the NYPD against these same students, they told those students, look, if you don't end your encampment now, I think they gave them an eight-hour time frame, an ultimatum. If you don't do that, we're going to bring in the National Guard. And, you know, that has a very emotive context in American politics because it was 54 years ago that the National Guard entered the campus at Kent State and shot 12 students, murdering four of them. That's how America remembers, and students of all generations interpret the idea, the threat that the National Guard will come on campus. We were talking to the students who are in the encampment. They said, look, we have to expose this. We have to ask an appeal for people to come and help. And instead of bowing, instead of capitulating to the demands, the threats of the Columbia administration, they issued a statement which all of us on the outside world started pumping out on social media. Come to Columbia. Come right now. Stand with the students, exposing the threat of the use of the National Guard. And in a couple hours, in 2 hours, thousands of people, perhaps more than 10,000 people, descended on Columbia's campus. And it made it quite clear to the university that this isn't going to end. The students aren't going to bow. And the next day, the very next day, these encampments started spreading like wildfire all over the country, at Princeton, today at George Washington University, at the University of Texas, where, you know, the state police, who did nothing for the kids at Uvalde when the mass shooter was shooting them, they were cowards. They stormed the campus and are brutalizing the students at the University of Texas. All of this took place, and it was like one of those pivotal moments. The Columbia students were, in a way, the catalyst, the epicenter for the new student movement. If they had capitulated, maybe it would have ended. But they didn't capitulate, and instead the protests have spread like wildfire.
Aside from conservative college administrators working hand-in-hand with local police departments, what other forms of repression are you and others witnessing around the country when people criticize Israel's actions? Are protest laws getting stricter, for example?
Well, I'll have to say that whether they're getting stricter or not in the last 6 or 7 months, police forces have been carrying out really vicious attacks against people engaged in protest. I'm in New York City today. I'm frequently in Washington. I've been in touch with people all over the country for the past 6 months who have been rounded up, who have been harassed, who have been beaten up, who have been arrested in cities and towns all around the country. And it's very interesting how this is playing out. Like, there was a group of young people, mainly young people, a couple older people, mass arrested for a car caravan in Providence, Rhode Island. The Providence police just came out and started, even though they were obeying traffic laws, even though they were peaceful, even though they were going to the state house in Providence in cars, the police just came out and started not only arresting them, but confiscating their cars. And why did the police say they did it? They had received intelligence that there was going to be a disruptive protest all around the country. So they began to become proactive. So it's sort of like the Occupy movement, where we see that this nefarious but quiet, silent, so-called intelligence operation in the United States notifying local authorities and police, be on the lookout, be on the alert, there's danger. So the police departments are treating protesters as enemy combatants rather than citizens or people in the United States exercising their cherished right of free speech. And this is happening all around the country. It's coordinated. We'll learn more, obviously, as the news comes out or as the files come out about how coordinated it is. But it's undoubtedly a coordinated effort to stop the mass protests, similar to what they did in the Occupy movement when between September 2011 and December 2011, there was a coordinated attack against the Occupy encampments. That ended the Occupy movement by December 2011. This is not going to end the Palestine movement. This is not only a U.S. movement, it's a global movement.
I think you're absolutely right, Brian. We remember how we found out later, in part because of the fine work of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund in D.C., that the Department of Homeland Security had been really on top of Occupy from its inception and worked, as you say, to shut that down. But back to Colombia for a minute. Even before the encampments, the Colombia administration enacted a policy whereby students are no longer allowed to post flyers on their dorm doors, something that is so integral to students' identities and to their educational experiences. It may be a simplistic question, but why are college administrators so up in arms about this outpouring of support for Palestinians?
Yeah, it's remarkable. The much touted academic freedom just got burned up, or the attempt by university administrations to burn it up has been so notable, so observable in the past 7 months. Why? I think it's two reasons. One, they're trustees, the donors. There's a great number of them who are very right-wing, very conservative, and many of whom are very strong supporters of the State of Israel. You could see that at the University of Pennsylvania. You saw that at Harvard. You see that also at Columbia. Robert Kraft just announced he's no longer going to be a donor because of the Palestine movement. So there's pressure from the donors, showing academic freedom is still in the box of sort of corporate capitalism, because the universities function really as money-making institutions and are dependent on the same class of people. I would call them the capitalist class, the donors who now pretend to be like loving schools and philanthropists, but really it's the same capitalist class. And the other is the pressure from Congress. I mean, the U.S. Congress is a disgusting institution when it comes to anybody trying to criticize Israel. For decades, if you criticized Israel, that meant that you were an anti-Semite, you were a friend of Nazism, you were a friend of fascism, you hated Jewish people if you criticized apartheid if it emanated from Tel Aviv. And so the U.S. Congress right now is carrying out a number of witch hunts. I mean, The university administrations are being hauled in front of Congress and queried and interrogated as if they're not doing enough to suppress their own student population, even though they are suppressing or trying to suppress the students. And then they're being forced to resign. They're, you know, they're caught between a rock and a hard place. But the one thing that they could do that would be in a different space is to stand with the students, stand with their own principles or purported principles about academic freedom and free speech. So far, they have basically complied with the pressure from donors, from trustees, and from Congress rather than standing with their own student population.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Haida Boghossian. We're speaking with Brian Becker on the situation on college campuses. Brian, how does this crackdown on free speech fit into the far right's regressive policies about what can be taught in schools, book bannings, and so on?
As we're going through a remarkable phase, it's as if the clock was set to go backwards. Books, education, things that were, you know, now being taught in U.S. schools, not well enough. This country and its tremendous productive prowess was built essentially by slave labor for centuries, something that's obviously true and now has been taught for the last decade because of the momentous achievements of the Black civil rights movement. Now that's being criminalized. That's being, you know, what's happening in the state of Florida to teachers, to educators. They're trying to not only take books out of the library, make it illegal in curriculums to talk about or teach the true history of the United States. Now you have a situation where young people especially are standing up in support of, in solidarity with the Palestinian people and against genocide and apartheid, and they're being demonized and caricatured. And, you know, it's not simply the right wing at this point. If you look at the New York Times, which is considered to be a Democratic or not a right wing newspaper, or the Washington Post or CNN, those media institutions are doing basically the same thing. Now, you know, all over the media in the last weeks and months, there's all of these articles against organizations like the Answer Coalition, the organization that I'm the national director of. Where are we getting our funding? Is the funding coming from China? Why we have to suppress TikTok? Why? Because TikTok is promoting pro-Palestinian views. And why? Because TikTok is an agent of China. Like every progressive protest now that's being manifested is being demonized, caricatured by the media, by powers that be, as something foreign, something sinister, something nefarious. In other words, everybody is the subject and target of outside agitation, similar to what they did to the Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. So this is the current political climate, but we can defeat it by standing up, by not succumbing, not being intimidated, and that's what's so hopeful and optimistic about this moment.
Brian, what do you say to people who claim, and we hear this literally every day, that standing up for Palestinian rights, for criticizing genocide, is anti-Semitic?
Yeah, it's based on two things. One, the basic propaganda sort of talking point of the Zionist propaganda machine and their supporters in the United States, meaning don't you dare criticize us because that means that you're somehow hating Jewish people, you're somehow sort of associated with Nazism. So basically just an intimidation tactic. But it's also has some traction because of ignorance. People in the United States don't really know the history that well. The Balfour Declaration, the British foreign minister who announced that Palestine, historic Palestine, would be divided and that there would be the sending Jews from Europe there to create a Jewish homeland. The British project was a colonial project. That was British colonialism in Iraq and Egypt, all over the Middle East. That was colonialism. And at that time, Britain didn't yet even control Palestine. It was still under the control of the Ottoman Empire. From the beginning, the Zionist project was a colonial project. So if you oppose colonialism in Latin America or in Africa or Asia or the Middle East, generally speaking, you know, that you would be on the side of justice. But if you don't think that the creation of Israel is part of a colonial project, if you think that it's only a consequence of the world reaching out to and providing safe haven for Jews after the trauma of the Holocaust in Europe, then you might be confused and think, well, if you're against what Israel is doing, that means you're against Jewish people, where everywhere else in the world, people, because they have more basic knowledge, it's not as hidden, would recognize, no, this isn't about hating any people. It's about disliking colonialism and the injustice of colonialism. Colonialism is the negation of democracy. There can't be anything less democratic than colonialism. The Israeli project was birthed by the colonizers of the world during the period of colonization.
Brian, are you aware of any college administrators who actually are respecting the right to free speech on their campuses?
Well, there must be some. I don't know their names at the moment, but there must be some. I'm just hoping that there has to be a few college administrators who are not bowing to the pressure. But, you know, these things have a – this is kind of herd mentality right now. If the university officials see other university officials cracking down, arresting protesters, as is happening in Texas, or right now as we speak at Princeton University – unfortunately, that gives everybody a green light to carry out the same repressive policies. That way they won't stand out as a sore thumb abuser of free speech. They're just part of the bigger team. So I don't know the names of any. I'm hoping that there are some. There must be some. But right now the trend is the students fighting for democracy and the university administrations kowtowing to police, congressional, and right-wing pro-Israeli pressure to negate democracy on their own campuses.
Well, my next question was going to be, do you think things will get worse before they get better? And I suppose what you've just said indicates that. But are you hopeful for better results in the next few months?
I think so. I really believe that the Israeli project, the Zionist project, is really not going to succeed. It's going to come to an end. And that doesn't mean, as the Zionist propaganda machine tries to suggest, that you're, quote, for wiping out everybody who lives in Israel or to wipe out the Jewish population. There's really two options available. There's going to be democracy in historic Palestine, where Muslims, Christians, and Jews live together as they had for centuries before the creation of Israel, living together as equals, meaning real democracy, or there's going to be the continuation of an apartheid state. And I just think, Heidi, that when you look at South Africa, even though the military there seemed omnipotent, its days were numbered because the world just turns against apartheid at a certain point. And those people who demand and want justice, who want democracy and people living in as equals rather than first and second class citizens, that trend dominates. And that's why I'm very optimistic right now. We've entered an era of liberation where the era of apartheid will eventually end, not tomorrow, not next week, but it's going to end. And there's going to be real democracy in historic Palestine for all the peoples who live there.
Brian Becker, what actions do you and others have planned for the next few weeks, and what can our listeners do about it, and what should they know about?
Well, I want to recommend people go to Shut It Down for Palestine, and then four is the number four. So shutitdownforpalestine.org or theanswercoalition.org. There are activities going on every day, every hour, all around the country. You can find out what's going on there at those two websites in particular. We're asking people who are not college students to come to the university encampments, be outside the university, help support the rallies. It builds morale inside for the students. It sends a message to the police and campus administrators. These students are not alone. We stand with you. That's happening all around the country. Right now, today, there was a new encampment at the CUNY colleges in New York City. People are gathering outside of CUNY to show support. That's going on at Columbia. So if you're not a student, you can come and show support for the students. This is a blossoming movement, and there's room for everyone.
Well, Brian, I live in downtown Manhattan, but you've inspired me to get myself up to Columbia to support everyone who's really being so principled and brave and trying to hold the administration accountable. We've run out of our allotted time, but as always, it's just a pleasure to have you with us, Brian. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
This is Michael Smith, and I've got some good news. Attorney Stephen Rohde is joining us as a co-host for Law & Disorder. As listeners may recall, we've had Steve Rohde on as a guest a number of times to speak about constitutional law questions. I first met Steve about 5 years ago in Los Angeles at a Julian Assange Defense Committee meeting. But Michael Ratner, the founder of Law & Disorder, knew Steve back at Columbia Law School in the 60s. Steve Rohde is a constitutional scholar, a lecturer, a writer, a political activist, and a retired civil rights lawyer. He's the founder and the chair of the Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. He's the past president of the ACLU of Southern California, and he's the past chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. And he's on the board of the Death Penalty Focus. Steve Rohde is the author of 2 books, American Words of Freedom, The Words That Define Our Nation, and Freedom of Assembly. And he's the co-author of Foundations of Freedom, A Living History of Our Bill of Rights. Attorney Stephen Rohde has written for a number of magazines, including the Los Angeles Times, the Huffington Post, and the American Prospect. And he's a graduate of Northwestern University and Columbia Law School. Regarded by many as the greatest journalist of our generation for exposing American war crimes, Julian Assange is about to be extradited at America's request to a federal criminal court in Virginia to be tried for his journalistic activities, which exposed extensive murderous American crimes and embarrassed the U.S. government, particularly the CIA. Julian was a young computer genius in Australia. He figured out a way to receive information from whistleblowers anonymously in order to protect them when his company, WikiLeaks, revealed to the world the activities of the CIA, the American military, and U.S. diplomats, and even the corruption of Hillary Clinton. As published by WikiLeaks, the Vault 7 revelations showed the CIA had developed technologies to turn our cell phones into listening devices, even when turned off, and tap our personal computers and even control our automobiles. WikiLeaks exposed American torture in Afghanistan. They published a video of an American gunship helicopter murdering Iraqi civilians, even children, and 2 Reuters journalists on the streets of Baghdad. Julian was given political asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he holed up for 7 years. Then 5 years ago, the British police, at America's request, removed him from the embassy and put him into solitary confinement in the notorious Belmarsh prison in London. Now the USA has succeeded in getting a compliant British court to extradite Julian, despite the law preventing extradition of political prisoners especially to a country that has the death penalty and no guarantee of freedom of speech. Today we speak with Vincent DiStefano. He's the National Organizing Director of the U.S. Julian Assange Defense Committee. Vincent DiStefano is on the Southern California ACLU Board of Directors and Executive Committee, and he has been a leading member of Amnesty International for four decades. Vincent DiStefano, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Michael. I'm happy to be here, particularly discussing this subject.
Former CIA Director Mike Pompeo called WikiLeaks a hostile foreign intelligence service. The CIA developed plans to kidnap and assassinate Julian Assange when he was in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. The Obama administration refused to indict Julian Assange because they realized that the major newspapers in the world that published his revelations would also need to be indicted. They called this the New York Times problem. Nevertheless, the Trump administration had Julian indicted for espionage, and the Biden Department of Justice, despite worldwide outcries, has not backed off. Where does Julian's case now stand as far as his ability to appeal earlier findings of the British court, paving the way for his extradition to the United States, and a rather certain conviction after trial in a highly conservative federal court in Virginia? Please answer this and include the most recent events and the assurances which the U.S. just provided.
Well, Michael, to answer that question accurately, it's important to remember that to date, Julian hasn't been tried for anything. What the British and U.S. legal systems have engineered is a kind of legal limbo for Julian Assange. Now, that limbo is where he's allowed to fight extradition over and over again, but he remains held in the worst prison, as you said, in Britain, under conditions already deemed torture by Nils Melzer, former UN rapporteur on torture. Now, the British courts keep dangling carrots of relief just out of Julian Defense's team reach, with the end result being Julian remains incarcerated, and a very embarrassing trial for the Biden administration during an election year is forestalled ad infinitum. Now, an example of these carrots can be found from his last hearing. Julian's defense team brought 9 objections against extradition, including, as you said in your introduction, the fact that CIA, under the direction of Mike Pompeo, had verified plans to kidnap and or kill Julian while he was still in the Ecuadorian embassy. Now, it's important to remember regarding those plans that they were hatched before any charges had been filed. It's kind of punishment first, trial later. Now, that alone should have been enough to dismiss the case. However, the court rejected it on the grounds that if extradited, that threat would no longer be an issue. Now, the argument makes sense, perhaps if it was an article in The Onion, but it's unbelievable and reprehensible to be coming from a court of law. In the end, the court allowed 3 of the 9 objections to be considered, but then allowed the U.S. team to provide assurances that could make those objections moot. Just another carrot dangled and then snatched away.
Vince, could you explain what each of those 3 grounds were? The court at this stage found to be credible legal arguments, and they would allow his appeal to go forward on those 3 grounds. What are they? But then what is this about assurances that they invited the U.S. government to make, and what has subsequently been done by the U.S. government?
Oh, thank you, Steve. That's an excellent question. And it's so Kafkaesque that even Kafka, I don't think, could dream this up. So let's look at the 3 objections to be considered. The first is that Julian would be subjected to the death penalty, and the U.S. offered an assurance that he would not face the death penalty, which seems pretty straightforward. Unfortunately, if he has to face additional charges, as Michael said earlier, for the Vault 7 releases, which is very likely, this assurance would only be for the current charges. The first assurance is that's assurance in name only. The second 2 objections that Julian would be denied a fair trial by virtue of the fact that he's not a U.S. citizen and that he had not allowed access to the First Amendment protection. Now, the embassy looked, understandably, at these 2 defense objections literally as one, and they addressed them both with 1 assurance. Now, the assurance reads, and I will quote, It would allow Assange the ability to raise and seek to reply upon, at trial, the rights and protections given under the First Amendment. Now, what I believe we have here, to use a Watergate-era reference, is a non-assurance assurance. Julian Assange, you have the right to ask for First Amendment protection at your trial. And then we have the right to consider your request and then deny it. In anyone's book, that's no assurance of any kind. As proof of how reliable those assurances are, please remember that Daniel Hale, very famous whistleblower, was offered very similar assurances in his whistleblower case. And at the end, they were not worth the paper they were printed on. The judge in his case assured him several things regarding his sentencing and incarceration, and not one of those assurances came to pass. However, there's a more disturbing element regarding the court asking for and being willing to accept these assurances. It's that the British courts appear to be grossly ignorant of the concept of the separation of powers, which is the foundation of our form of governance. What the British courts fail to understand, either through ignorance or perhaps by willful disregard, is that the U.S. Embassy speaking for the executive branch can make all the assurances they want. However, separation of powers allows the judicial branch to ignore those assurances coming from the executive branch, as they did in Daniel Hale's case. The U.S. assurances are no assurances at all, plain and simple.
You're quite right. In fact, some U.S. lower courts have found that foreign nationals have no First Amendment rights. So I think the U.S. government is being very coy, and I want to get your comment on this, in saying that Julian can raise and seek First Amendment protection. That sounds like he can raise and seek a finding that 2 + 2 = 5. It doesn't say he has First Amendment rights in the United States. Is that accurate?
You've described it perfectly, Stephen. Again, if this is too Kafkaesque for even Kafka, it is not really any kind of an assurance at all. And I think it's almost ham-fisted on the face of it. And again, the fact that the courts, the British courts, failed to recognize that whatever assurances the executive branch gives, the judicial branch, by the separation of powers, is under no obligation to abide by them.
Its unfamiliarity may stem from the lack of a written constitution in the United Kingdom, and their misunderstanding that in the end it's going to be the courts that have the power. Now, I understand on May 20 there'll be a hearing on this?
Yes, there will. There'll be a resolution on this where the Julian's defense will be able to present their three objections, and then the U.S. courts will be able to provide their two for the three objections assurances. And I don't think that the prosecution is being foxy on this. The fact that he would be denied a fair trial based on the fact that he's an Australian, that he would be denied his First Amendment rights as a non-citizen, those are one and the same thing, and that's why this assurance that says, of course, you can ask for it, and again, we can deny it. You can't make this stuff up.
Doesn't it leave open the possibility that the government will argue against? Tell us about a witness that the government put up at the extradition hearings who virtually sealed the fate of Julian by testifying that there was no First Amendment protection. Cronenberg, who was from the Justice Department,
he found it difficult to say that he wouldn't face the death penalty because he realized that there would be charges that could be added. And the Vault 7 releases have embarrassed the CIA to a degree that are historic. And so if he was charged for that, he could face the death penalty for that. And of course, when Cronenberg was offered the question, would he be provided First Amendment rights? I think quite understandably, he waffled on that because he knew that our system is designed not to provide those First Amendment protections to people who are not U.S. citizens. So for the U.S. Embassy in the guise of the executive branch to say, well, yes, we'll offer them that, it is really, again, one of those carrots that they'll dangle and then snatch. And so I think, again, it's a non-assurance assurance that flies in the face of logic.
Vincent DiStefano, you're the head of the Julian Assange Defense Committee here in the United States, and you've been following this closely. I want to ask you about British law. Please talk about how British law has been trashed in the process of America's pursuit of Julian.
Well, you know, the unfortunate thing is if we look at the proceedings that have occurred since he began trial nearly 5 years ago when he was snatched illegally and immorally from the British embassy, it makes the Queen of Hearts Court appear logical and reasonable because they have denied everything that the defense put together a 150-page document that outlined multiple reasons why this extradition could not go forward. And the three-judge panel, a Judge Swift, summarily dismissed that entire document with a three-page double-spaced denial without addressing a single point in the document. And that's why when the court case occurred in February, the final hearing that we just had, the two jurists that were there listened and asked rather pertinent questions. But because the court has been willing to operate in a quisling manner at the behest of the U.S. government, it seems to be that they are going through a pantomime, providing the appearance of being reasonable, and then at the last minute, they'll snatch the rug out from under Julian.
Michael and I are interested also in whether Assange has any right to seek relief in the European Court of Human Rights.
Oh, Stephen, thank you very much, because that is a really important issue here. To answer that question, let me say yes and no. Assange has the right to, and his defense team has given notice to the European Court of Human Rights that once all legal avenues of Britain have been exhausted, something that must happen before the ECHR can even look at the case, that they plan to bring their case to the European Court of Human Rights if the extradition is to move forward. The unfortunate thing is that the British or U.S. authorities, if recent history has taught us anything, could simply choose to ignore the court's willingness to either hear the case or, if the case goes forward, any ultimate decision that the court would make, as they have done in the past, when they found rulings by even their own rules-based order inconvenient for them. On the other hand, if the extradition is approved, Julian could be put on a plane literally within hours of that decision before his defense team even has an opportunity to make their move to the HRC. However, there is hope that the U.S. government would allow the case to go forward in the HRC, but again, for very, very, I think, cruel and mendacious reasons. And that is, there's a good reason why the Brits and the Yanks might allow this case to go forward before the ECHR. The sad reason is that it would simply be one more carrot to keep Julian imprisoned until after the election. Yes, you can go before the Human Court of Human Rights, but you stay in Belmarsh Prison. It's really a sad state of affairs. He, you know, heads he loses and tails he loses.
Please talk about the U.S. Julian Assange Defense Committee, which you head, and what it has done so far, and what kind of support does Julian have, and what the Defense Committee is doing now.
Well, there is a case that was brought in the Spanish court by several lawyers. That would be Margaret Ratner-Kunstler, Deborah Hebrick, and along with two journalists, John Getz and Charles Glass. Their devices were confiscated and copied, and their conversations with Julian were observed and recorded when they visited him in the Ecuadorian embassy. Since Deborah and Margaret were part of his legal team, it's a very clear abridgment of the attorney-client privilege. So we are working very carefully with those individuals on their case. Now, that case is incredibly important. The CIA attempted to quash this case in Spain, where they expected a more favorable court. However, after hearing the CIA's complaint, Manhattan-based U.S. District Court Judge John Cottle said accessing the contents of their phone, if that occurred, invaded the visitor's privacy rights under the U.S. Constitution. He went on to say the misconduct alleged is a violation of the plaintiff's reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of their electric devices under the Fourth Amendment. Now, this decision by Judge Caudill is historic because it will now allow discovery regarding the CIA operations, something that is as rare as hen's teeth. The CIA has really never been forced to provide this kind of discovery. Now, this has broad implications for the case for Julian and our actions at Assange defense. That's because once those CIA operations are made public, they can then be presented by Julian's defense at his trial. Now, those revelations could be highly embarrassing to the Biden administration, the CIA. And this is incredibly important. That's why currently William Burns, the head of the CIA, is fighting this decision vigorously. He's invoked the National Security Act of 1947, the Central Intelligence Agency Act of 1949, to refuse to provide any information after Judge Caudill has allowed it of CIA operations and discovery. Now, if he's successful, it would have a horrible implication for Julian and these four individuals, all U.S. citizens' right to know what their government does that they wish to hide. So what is Assange defense doing? In collaboration with civil organizations around the world, and especially with Julian's family, we're working to free Assange. Previously, our efforts were end extradition, but unfortunately, Julian's health is so bad now, and the conditions of imprisonment are so harsh that there are very credible fears that he might not survive much longer. So our efforts are focused right now on House Resolution 934. And this is a bipartisan resolution that's expressing the sense of the House of Representatives that regular journalist activities are protected under the First Amendment, that the United States ought to drop all charges against and attempts to extradite Assange. Now, there are 11 bipartisan co-signers, and these are people who agree about nothing. It's people from the Squad and MAGA members, and it's incredibly important. So we have reached out. Our efforts right now are to reach out to five congressmen who previously signed onto a letter that was crafted by the Republican Thomas Massey and the conservative Democrat Tim McGovern to stop the extradition, but have yet to sign on to this one. They are Pramila Jayapal, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Anya Presley, Jesus Chuy Garcia, and Greg Cesar. And of course, we're asking everyone, in addition to phoning these people and asking them, these congressmen, why haven't you signed? We're asking you to call your own congressman as well. We're asking everyone as well to be present at all events on May 3rd, World Press Freedom Day. Now, this is incredibly important. The Biden administration and Joe Biden made very, very strong statements in defense of freedom of the press. Journalism is not a crime. And yet, although at the D.C. Press Club coming up on May 3rd, they will be talking about Evan Gershkovich, but they will be silent. They will be moot on their own prosecution of a journalist for the crime of journalism. So we're asking people to be at those May 3rd events. Make your voices heard in defense of journalism by calling for Julian to be freed immediately and unconditionally. We're calling on all press freedom and human rights organizations, many of which are already with us in this. People like Reporters Without Borders, Human Rights Watch. I could go on. There are hundreds and hundreds of organizations. And if you go to the AssangeDefense.org website, you can see the hundreds of organizations that are standing behind us, the hundreds of individuals and intellectuals who see this for what it is, a dagger at the heart of the First Amendment. So one organization that has been absent from this, although they have a petition for Julian Assange, is an organization you mentioned. I've personally spent more than four decades working as an urgent action letter writer for Amnesty International. But ASI USA, and I believe quite frankly for fundraising reasons, has chosen not to provide Julian this very important designation. Like I said, I've written urgent action letters for more than four decades. If Julian Assange is not a prisoner of conscience, the word has no meaning. And so we are lobbying. We've been very successful with AI in Spain and several other countries, and Assange Defense is working in concert with other amnesty groups to get amnesty to sign on board. And internationally, we've been very, very good. We have people who are supporting us. But here domestically, it's been a much more difficult fight. So what I would suggest the audience to do, as I said, go to AssangeDefense.org in the U.S. If you're in the U.K. or you have access to the U.K., go to StellaAssange.com and AssangeCampaign.org.au in Australia. You can make and take appropriate action where you live. You can contribute to our efforts financially. We operate on a shoestring budget. Most of us are volunteers. But the most important thing our listeners can do is to raise your voices. You have to be so loud. Now, unfortunately, the situation, the horrific situation in Gaza, has made taken all the oxygen out of the room for Julian. However, because Julian has been in the forefront of fighting for Palestinian rights and revealing documents about the duplicity of the apartheid state of Israel, we believe that there is an opportunity for us to act in concert at all of these huge protests that are taking place across college campuses. We have flyers that show how Julian worked on this vociferously for years, long before anyone else did. And we believe by acting in concert with those organizations, we can bring the power of their numbers to this fight.
With the limited time we have left, really, what happens if Julian is extradited and he's tried on these charges under the infamous Espionage Act of 1917 in the Eastern District of Virginia? What's happened to whistleblowers in that district, and what does all this mean to investigative journalism?
Well, Stephen, that is an excellent question, and it really is the question. To be clear, if Julian is convicted, it will spell the end of investigative journalism, freedom of the press, and more importantly, the public's right to know all in one fell swoop, and not just for the U.S., but for the rest of the world as well. Now, this is not hyperbole, because once this precedent is set in stone, with a conviction, it could be used by any other government when any journalist prints truthful information they find embarrassing. Let me make one note here. WikiLeaks, in its entire lifespan, has never had to issue a retraction. Everything they printed was the truth. In addition to that, General Carr, a five-star general during the trial, said no one was even harmed by what the WikiLeaks revealed. So what we have here is a journalist being prosecuted for providing the truth. So the real question is, can Julian get a fair trial in the Eastern District Court of Virginia once he's extradited here? Now, that's highly unlikely, because the court itself sits at the very hub of the intelligence communities, which WikiLeaks embarrassed to a degree beyond comprehension and not known in our history. Their employees always make up the jury pools in that court. That's why this court has a mind-boggling 98.2% conviction rate in all whistleblower cases. I've had friends of mine who've been convicted at this court. It makes, as I said, the Queen of Hearts court look like superb jurisprudence. Lastly, and most importantly for Julian, the 1917 Espionage Act does not allow a public benefit defense. Therefore, when he gets to court, all those people that say, well, you should man up and go back and face the jury, there's only one question the court's going to ask. And there are only two possible answers to the question. Did you do what you're charged with? And the two possible answers are yes and no. That means he can't say, yes, I did it for the public's benefit. It's a near certainty that he's sent to the court. It's game over for Julian and press freedom around the world. Because again, as we see with Evan Gershkovich, what the Russian government has done, they used a precedent set by the Biden administration incarcerating Julian, and all governments could do it anywhere. The United States can snatch any reporter off the street, as could Saudi Arabia, China, Romania, Turkey. Anyone can grab a reporter and haul them back to their country to stand trial in their country for printing the truth. That is the threat we face.
I think that we have here an example, along with the International Court of Justice ruling Israel is plausibly committing genocide, the United States ignoring that ruling, and now we have what's going on with the Julian Assange case. It's very, very troubling what's happening, and you've done a terrific job in explaining to our audience what's at stake here in the Julian Assange Defense Committee. Thank you, Vincent.
Thank you, Michael and Stephen, both, for having me on to discuss this subject, because this is so incredibly important. And also because it is almost entirely absent from the mainstream media. That's why alternative outlets like the Pacifica are so incredibly important. You can't fight against something if you don't know it's taking place. So thank you both for having me on.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
If you're talking, they will hear you.
Why are we getting killed like this?
Kyle's not here. Got caught drinking beer in the park a couple of nights ago.
Really?
Yeah. Zero tolerance. He's out for the season.
Harsh.
Hey, he knew not to drink. We've made that clear to all of our kids, right?
No, not really.
Bill, if we don't tell them what we expect and why they shouldn't drink, how are they going to know?
Talk. They hear you. For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
You are listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh, and streaming online at wrct.org.
I'm sure you're familiar with the kind of necktie parties we hold out here in the West. And the kind where the horse runs from underneath the guest of honor is the kind I like the best. And the side ain't rumored to be very pretty to see a man hang from a tree. You know everybody turns their heads so as not to look. Everybody except me. I'm the guy who slaps the horse, and I sure enjoy my duty. The guy who slaps the horse, that last guy was sure a beauty. I came to this town almost 15 years ago, and I've been here since that time. But it's just been in the past 5 years or so that I've had this job of mine. 4 or 5 years ago, some outlaws killed my wife and children. That had its effect on my mind. So when the sheriff offered me the dreaded job of hangman, I said, that suits me fine. Now I'm the guy who slaps the horse, and I sure enjoy my duty. The guy who slaps the horse, that last guy was sure a beauty. I don't care what you hear from some prophet or some preacher, 'cause I know that revenge is sweet. And I can't help but grin at every single outlaw when all of a sudden there's no horse under his feet. And you probably think I'm strange, you might think that I'm disgusting, but it's my job, I handle it with pride. I've nothing left to live for since the passing of my family. My heart died with them, so did my mind. Now I'm the guy who slaps the horse, and I sure enjoy my duty. The guy who slaps the horse, that last guy was sure a beauty. I'm the guy who slaps the horse, and I sure enjoy my duty. The guy who slaps the horse, that last guy was sure a beauty.
Oh. much. I never could find the Midas touch. I take what comes and do my best and don't worry about the rest. I'll never become a millionaire. No fancy cars, no Perrier. I wake each day with a smile on my face and I